Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you will see the link in the upper right-hand corner for becoming a Patreon sponsor. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we do not have any guests again, so we are going to go back into the archives of the old bodybuilding magazines. I've been looking through some of the old magazines I had, and I found the first official IFBB Grand Prix, which started in, I believe, 1980. So when Wayne D'Amelio joined the IFBB in the late 1970s, he started promoting professional bodybuilding events. And you may not know this, but up until that point, the only professional bodybuilding competition in the world was the Mr. Olympia contest, which was only, by the way, offering $1,000 in prize money. And then when Arnold and Jim Lorimer took it over in 1976, I think they increased it to, I think it was $5,000 for first place. Wayne D'Amelio started in 1978 with the Night of the Champions, and he also held that in 1979. But in 1980, they decided to come up with this idea of a Grand Prix Tour, which would be about, in 1980, they had five different cities, and the contests were held only a couple weeks apart. And I believe the contests were in Miami, Florida, and Pittsburgh, and Los Angeles, and I think Pennsylvania. And then the final one, which was, of course, in New York for the Night of the Champions. So there were five competitions. It was pretty much the same bodybuilders competing throughout those contests. And it was really exciting. I remember being 17 years old and reading Muscle and Fitness magazine in the summer of 1980. And every month they would have a great contest report, great photos, great writing about each one of the individual Grand Prix shows. So they were spaced like a month apart, or at least they were in the magazines. And then they would also have the flash report of the last contest, which was like the next one coming up on the agenda and who won that. And then you would look forward to the next issue and then see who won those contests. So I thought it'd be cool if we just read all five reports of the 1980 Grand Prix Tour in order and just see how they all went. So Chris Dickerson was the big winner, but he had a really good showdown that year with Casey Viator, who was in fantastic shape. And I believe Casey was just coming back into the IFBB. Casey, of course, won the 1971 Mr. America at 19 years old, and he shocked the bodybuilding world that someone so young could be so massive and so well-developed. And then Casey kind of fell off the wagon, and he just never competed again. He just stopped training, I think, and he got involved in doing construction. And then he had a construction accident where he cut off part of his finger. And then Arthur Jones did that famous Colorado experiment where he got Casey back in shape in like, I don't know, was it a couple of weeks or something? And he gained all this weight. He gained like 60 pounds of muscle or something in a month. And then Casey finally came back into competition in 1978, but he went over to the NABBA Mr. Universe first, and he took second place to Dave Johns. And then I believe in 1979, at the end of 1979, he competed, and I think it was the Canada Cup. It was right after the Olympia, after Zane won his third Olympia. And then in 1980, Casey was on the tour and he looked fantastic. Very big, very thick, more cut than he's ever been. So these were really, really exciting contests. And it kind of gets lost, I think, in the discussion because, of course, later that year, we had the 1980 Mr. Olympia. And that is, people are still talking about that 40-something years later. So I think this Grand Prix Tour is not really talked about that much. And then they did it again in 1981. I think they kept going with it for a while, for a couple of years. But I think the first year they did it, which was 1980, it was really, really exciting. The guys were all in good shape. Some were in better shape later in the year, like Boyer Coe would always peak later in the year. But as we'll read about, Ed Corney was in fantastic shape for this contest. They said his lifetime best condition ever. And I believe that was at the New York show. We'll find out when I read these. But it was really some fun, exciting competitions. So we will get to that in a minute. We've got some bad news in the bodybuilding world. Ruth Silverman, who was a great writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine, and then she worked for Iron Man magazine. That's where I met her when I was working for Iron Man. And then she also worked for Digital Muscle, which was the online magazine for a few years. So Ruth has passed away, unfortunately. So I was very sad to hear that last night. I got a chance to know Ruth on many occasions. Of course, working for Iron Man, I would go to the Arnold Classic, or I would go to the Pro Iron Man contest that they held, and she was always there, or at the Olympia. And a very nice lady, very supportive, very knowledgeable, and very, very opinionated. I think she got her degree in journalism from the University of Chicago. So we had that in common because I grew up in Chicago. And it was very much like talking to people who were educated like her and had degrees, you know, because not many people, I guess, in the bodybuilding world had degrees. So she was really impressed with people who had college degrees, because I had a college degree. And especially if you were in the writing field like she was in journalism. Yeah, I was very sad to hear that. I don't know what she passed away from. I don't even know how old she was. I think the last time I saw Ruth was in 2018 when Old School Labs brought me out to Venice, California, and I hung out with Samir Banute, and they had a Muscle Beach show every Memorial Day, Labor Day, and on July 4th. And I believe I was out there for the July 4th one, and that's when Phil Williams got inducted into the Muscle Beach Hall of Fame. So we had a little breakfast beforehand, and John Bailiff was there, and Ruth was there, and Jerry Branum, and of course, Phil, Bob Birdsong was there, a couple really great people from the bodybuilding industry. So I got to talk to her then. I think that was the last time I saw her. But I did do an interview with Ruth, I believe it was a couple of years later or right around that time. I was trying to get some bodybuilding interviews on my Bodybuilding Legends podcast for women bodybuilders, and I was having a hard time getting women bodybuilders. So I think Ruth was the first guest that I had where we talked about the women's side of the sport. So I will put the link to that interview below on the description of this podcast. So if you want to check that out, you can hear our last interview. I believe it was just an audio interview. We didn't do it by video then, because I believe that was before I started doing the videos. But it was great to hear Ruth's comments, and we will miss her. She was a great talent in the world of bodybuilding. So I was looking on her Facebook page, and I saw some tributes to her. So I wanted to read some of these. Dave Palumbo said, rest in peace, Ruth Silverman, former senior editor of Iron Man magazine, editor at Digital Muscle, and former panelist at the Fitness View on Official RX Muscle. Oh, that's right. Dave had a show on for a while called the Fitness View on RX Muscle, and she was part of that. That's right. I forgot about that. Dave said, I've known Ruth since 1990, and I can honestly say from the day I first met her, we were instant friends. I loved every discussion and debate we had over the years because she always called it like she saw it. I received the unfortunate news minutes ago from my friend, Nancy Fitview, Nancy Norman, who became a close friend and confidant of Ruth over the last several years. She will be missed by our industry, her friends, and loved ones. Prayers and love to her family during this tough time. Michelle Blank, who is a fitness competitor, said, rest in peace, Ruth Silverman. Thank you for being such a great supporter of the IFBB Pro Fitness Division. This is Fitness, IFBB Pro Fitness. And then Nancy Norman said, very sad news. My dear friend and veteran bodybuilding editor and reporter, Ruth Silverman, has passed away. I met Ruth many years ago in the 1990s, but I became much closer with her in the last 10 years, especially after doing the Fitness View together and working at Digital Muscle with her. I just spoke to her about the Olympia. We, of course, argued about placings, and of course, Ruth knew more about the current competitors' names than I did. I will deeply miss my longtime loyal and dear friend. What a tremendous loss for the sport, and definitely leaving a hole in my heart. Dave Lieberman wrote a nice tribute to Ruth. He said, rest in peace, Ruth Silverman. This has truly been a rough week. As I learned today, former editor of Iron Man magazine, Ruth Silverman, has passed away. Not only was she an industry great, she was a personal friend who'll be enormously missed. I've known Ruthless Ruth, perfect nickname from Iron Man's Lonnie Tepper, over half my life. In fact, thanks to Lonnie, I became close with the entire Iron Man crew, and Ruth was one of those people I bonded with instantly. Most important, I've been a personal friend of hers, and she will be forever missed by me. I'm so fortunate to have seen her one last time at Lonnie's MPC West Coast Classic when we all had dinner the night prior to the contest and experienced the amazing Sunday brunch at the world-renowned Mission Inn in Riverside, California. I remember being in LA 1 month earlier for a music fest, and I was debating if I should skip the next trip. After discussing this in length with LT, We both came to the conclusion that time with loved ones is something never to be taken for granted, as there very well may not be a next year. This was sadly the case with Ruth's passing, and I can honestly say I don't regret a thing, and I thank God we made the right choice to head back to California. As I sit here recovering from knee replacement surgery this past Tuesday, I feel eternally grateful that I experienced all the many wonderful memories with great friends. I had no idea that this past June would be the last time I would see Ruth, but I'm certainly glad that I did. My deepest and most sincere condolences to all of Ruth Silverman's friends and family. You're going to be tremendously missed, my friend. Heidi Sullivan said, rest in peace, Ruth Silverman. You're always one of the kindest bodybuilding reporters who never hesitated to call it like she saw it. Ruth, thank you for your years of dedication to the industry and the athletes. Your presence and your words will be missed. Gretchen Sadudin said, she was my best friend in the industry. After COVID and my vax descent, she withdrew from me. She did not want to hear about my and my boss's disputes with Fauci, which was unlike her really incisive, inquiring mind. Then I was told by a mutual friend that she had not been feeling well with no explanation. I hope she is now in heaven taking copious notes on bodybuilding friends we lost recently. Actually, there are more there than here these days. I miss Lonnie's last show for the first time, but the last time I went, we hung out together the entire time, and it was a happy blessing after the death of my dad. I will miss her so much. Every show I ask, have you seen Ruth yet? Nobody asks Ruth who, as we all know and love her. I'm so sad to hear this news. Rest in peace, Ruthless. Sharon Bruneau, top fitness model competitor, said, many hearts are heavy today as we've lost an amazing member and friend in the Iron family. Ruth Silverman, former editor of Flex Magazine, senior editor of Iron Man Magazine, and editor at Digital Muscle. Ruth completed an incredible journey, one that touched the hearts and lives of many. Fly high, my dear, sweet friend. You will be missed. My sincere condolences to Ruth's family and dear friends. Love you, Ruthless. Corey Everson said, I'm so extremely sorry to hear of Ruth's passing. Ruth and I go back decades, as she was one of my dearest friends at Weeders and then Iron Man Magazine. I just saw her a few weeks ago at a Joe Wheatley event. I'm saddened and shocked at her passing. My heart goes out to all of her family and friends. And if there's anything I can do to help, please let me know. Ruth was a sister in iron, an amazing writer, but best of all, a wonderful and loyal friend who I will always cherish. I am holding you tight, Ruthie. I always will. Love you so much. Heaven just gained another amazing angel. Kat Tripoli said, the iron world just lost an amazing sister today. I'm so saddened to hear of Ruth Silverman's passing. She was a wonderful writer, editor, and listener. She was there when I was competing in the 80s, and we remained friends until her passing. My heart goes out to her family. She will be so terribly missed in our world. Rest in peace, Ruth. Godspeed, my friend. June Monroe said, there are no words to express my sadness hearing that my dear friend and industry icon, Ruth Silverman, passed away this afternoon. Too many years to count, but not enough now. I will miss our yearly pajama party at Lonnie Teeper's WCC show, hearing about all the interesting and different things you were doing and confiding as good friends do. Never would have thought this past June would be our last one on this earth. None of our tight-knit gang, Lonnie Teeper, Dave Lieberman, Elsa Escobar, and Josephine Piano, would have ever thought it would be. I'll miss sharing pics of our four-legged babes, too. Already had the Christmas card ready. Rest in peace, my friend. Kurt James said, note the Ruth Silverman edit. Rest in peace to a wonderful proofreader, a great writer, and a true friend in bodybuilding. I will miss you, Ruth. Stacy Nato said, this is a tremendous loss for the bodybuilding community. Ruth Silverman was so funny, engaging, and had such a passion for the sport and everyone involved in it. She will be missed. All right. So she went to Northwestern University. I stand corrected. I thought it was University of Chicago. And she studied communications, theater, and speech education. And she's originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So, yeah, the thing that stands out from all those tributes is her dedication. She was a dedicated reporter, and that's not very celebrated in the bodybuilding community. Of course, we celebrate the athletes, but sometimes we forget about the writers. We forget about the photographers. We forget about the editors. We forget about the people who put together those magazines, which as I look through some of these old magazines I got, what a tremendous feat that was every month to put these things together. I mean, there's so many great articles from these old magazines, the pictures, the way it's all put together. I mean, these muscle and fitnesses that I'm going to read for you today, they have about 175 pages, and they put these out every month. It's just incredible. These are all gone now. Of course, there's no more magazines, and it's such a shame because as I was looking through these old ones from 1980, it just brought back all this flood of memories from when I was 17 years old in the summer of 1980 in Chicago, reading these magazines, and I was so excited. They contributed so much to my love of bodybuilding, and now I just feel sorry for the people today because they're gone. They're just all gone. There's no more magazines. There's no more of this great coverage. There's no more of this great writing, these great photos, these reports. They just added so much to the magic, the love for bodybuilding that we all had back then. And now it's just so different now. And don't even get me started about the gyms. All right. So rest in peace, Ruth. We will miss you. I didn't see her that often. I didn't talk to her as much as some of those other people who left tributes. But she was a great person, like I said, really dedicated to the sport and covering it. And what Nancy said is absolutely true. She knew more about any of these women than I would ever know. I mean, when I would talk to her, she'd rattle off names and their background, and she knew what was going on with every single person. She was really an amazing reporter. So rest in peace. All right. I only got one email this week, actually in the last 2 weeks, because we haven't been on for a couple of weeks because we had Thanksgiving last week. If you guys want to email me about anything, you can do that by sending me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. This one says, "Hey, John, I'm a longtime listener of the podcast since the early days of the show. I love anything old school bodybuilding, and anything about Mike Mentzer is always fantastic. I totally dig hearing any extra tidbits and wisdom about his training and lifestyle. Paul Becker, in one of your recent episodes, mentioned the Mike Mentzer training videos he made right before he passed. I found those only a few months ago on YouTube with a fellow who has uploaded a big plethora of Mike Mentzer-related material. His channel is called Heavy Duty College. I'll link his page below. Those workout videos are really something special. I had a few of Mike's books, and reading is one thing, but seeing the exact cadence and style of his heavy duty in action really made me understand. Combine that with the audio tapes Mentzer recorded too, and there's a wealth of historical information from the man. Being able to personally train with him had to be legendary. Keep up the good podcast work in the golden age glory. I'll be sure to keep on listening. And if you ever decide to throw some bronze and silver age bodybuilding history and articles in the mix, I'm all ears. The 1800s to the early 1900s is full of so much interesting stories, great training, and lost information in the muscle building world. Sincerely, Spencer Scott Holmes, that Pizza Boys comics guy. oldmanorange.com. All right. Thank you, Spencer. I appreciate that. That's a great idea about the old 1800s and 1900s. I'm just finishing a book on Eugene Sandow. Yeah, that would be some really good information. Maybe I could get a guest who knows more about that than I do, and we could talk about that. But that's a great idea. I've usually been sticking, of course, with the 1960s to the 1980s with this podcast, but that might be a great idea to delve into that. All right. And then I did put up a video just yesterday on my YouTube channel, which is under my name, John Hansen. And it's this was from a February 2022 interview I did with Jerry Branum, where we were doing our year-end reviews that we do every year. So this was 1991, and this was part two. I put part one up about a week ago. So if you haven't been on my YouTube channel, check these out. They were both really good. They're both about an hour and a half long. And in part two, we covered the Mr. USA contest, which was won that year by Mike Matarazzo. We also cover the 1991 NPC Nationals, which was won by Kevin Lavroni in an all-star lineup that included Flex Wheeler, Paul DeMeo, Ronnie Coleman, when he was still natural, supposedly, Matt Mendenhall, and Chris Cormier, and a bunch of other really top guys, many of whom would go on to be pros. And then, of course, we talked about the 1991 Mr. Olympia, which was the last one won by Lee Haney. And as you know, me and Jerry, we always go on tangents and talk about lots of other stuff as well. So check that out. I'll read some of the comments from that video right here. All right. David said, "Matarazzo looks better than any open class competitor today." Justin said, "These two work together. Definitely the best bodybuilding show on YouTube." Gennaro says, "Look how much quality muscle on Lee Haney's physique. His choice of music and posing routine was mesmerizing. Yeah, I put the full routine of Lee Haney from the 1991 Mr. Olympia, and it really was amazing to watch again. God, compared to how they pose today, it's just light years ahead. Just amazing. I wish some bodybuilders would take the time, man, pick up some good music and do a good routine. These guys today are just really pathetic in their posing. This one says, Mike Matarazzo was in great shape this year. I just started lifting, and I remember his pictures from magazines. He was ripped, dry, even his tan was perfect. Yeah, I agree. Matarazzo was so peaked for that contest. He looked fantastic. This one says, Lee Haney's posing routine from the 91-0 is perfect and how you should display a physique to music. Today, they rely on cupping their ears to get a round of applause. Agreed. This one says, wow, Ronnie looked far better in his first competitions. Way more symmetry. Insane arms, waist was tight, everything, in fact. When he gained too much, he became bloated, and that era ushered in the bubble guts. This one says, Jerry is a treasure. So much experience and knowledge. Thanks for having him on. This one says, very hard to see anyone beat the 8-in-a-row record for the Mr. Olympia. First of all, it's an age thing. In modern bodybuilding, they hit their peak in their 30s. So in order to break the record, you'd have to last well into your 40s, which is hard to do as injuries happen. Also, the muscle and the receptors become chemically tired from all the drugs. The only choice is for someone quite young to win. Derek and Nick Walker come to mind and somehow manage to keep improving. Another thing working against the breaking of the record is the judging. In the last few years, they switched champs a lot more. So stringing along 8 wins is close to impossible. Yes, great point. They are doing that now. In fact, if you look at since 2018, I think we've had almost a different Mr. Olympia every year. I think the only one that repeated was Rami, Big Rami. He only won 2. Everyone else has just won 1 time, and then that's it. This one says, I got to see that 91 and 93 Mr. Olympia. Those were the best, and those are some amazing routines. Dave Thomas said, brilliant, John. Thanks for doing another great podcast with Jerry. You know what, John? Out of all the podcasts you do, including the pro bodybuilders, Jerry's are always the best. And no, I'm not getting commission for saying that. Garrett said, Jerry's great. He gets real animated when angry, and he doesn't hold back. Gennaro said, Sonny looks amazing in the front lat spread next to Yates. I miss seeing him and speaking to him. That was in our coverage of the 91 Night of the Champions, where Sonny Schmidt took 2nd to Dorian. Jeffrey said, Matt Mendenhall was the most genetically gifted bodybuilder on that stage. Anthony said, 3 minutes in, great show already. This one said, this video sets an exceptional benchmark. Value the journey as it shapes your path to greatness. Wow, thank you. That was nice. This guy says, great effing episode. I could listen to these badasses for hours. This one says, your videos always make me feel inspired. Mike says, I never touch gear, elite 40, now healthy, I work out, lift weights. But when I was younger, an older man in the gym I listened to, he said, don't take anything unless you're going to compete or there's some type of money involved. Just do it for your health. I'm so happy I listened 30 some odd years later. Neil says, Mr. Hansen, could you do something on Sonny Schmidt and Roger Walker if possible? Well, we did do an interview with Roger. So if you check our podcast link, just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com and click podcast, and it's on there. So check that out. That was a really good interview. Roger was great. Latman said, did Jerry Branum forget that Bill Pearl passed away in 2022? I just went to the WMBF World Championships. That was one of the best competitions I've seen in over 30 years of judging and competing. And I've been to some of the best Mr. Olympias and national competitions. Oh, that's good to hear. As far as Jerry saying that, we recorded it in February, and Bill Pearl passed away later that year. So that's why he mentioned Bill being alive. Mike said in 92, if they gave it to Kevin, it would have been better off to have Kevin and Flex Wheeler as Mr. Olympias throughout the 90s. Jody said there are bizarre moral undertones to the attitude towards natural training as well. It's as if by not using drugs, you're doing something harmful or wrong. The criticism is either, oh, so you think you're better than us, people who do use drugs, or something like, well, you might look good through training and diet alone, but that's genetics. And so by doing so, you're giving others unrealistic expectations, body image problems, and all the rest. So they'd be better off expecting the need for drugs from the get-go. Meanwhile, when someone likes to go on about what drugs and regimes they do, everyone's like, oh, you're so brave and honest and doing everyone a service by normalizing the drugs. This guy says, why didn't you report on Sean Davis's death? I don't know. On the video? We're not going to do that on the video. The video was recorded in February of 2022. And then this one also says, John, Jerry says Bill is still living. Is this an old video? Yes. Bill Pearl passed away in September. Like I said, we recorded the video in February. I'm just trying to get caught up on all these old videos I've got. All right. So that's it for our opening. Let's get to these articles. These are awesome articles. You guys will love these. So the first one comes from the June 1980 Muscle and Fitness. It's written by Marilyn Guzman. It's about the Florida Grand Prix, and it's called First Stop Miami. Dickerson and Viator go down to the wire in an incredibly close finish, and the Grand Prix is off to a flying start. As we begin a new decade, one can only reflect on the astounding metamorphosis bodybuilding has undergone. What were once ideas and dreams in the minds of Ben and Joe Weider are now full-fledged realities. Goals are constantly being reached, only to make way for newer and higher goals. The frenzy and growing pains experienced during the 70s seems to have diminished. Bodybuilding has come of age, and as it enters the 80s with total dignity. That was clearly evident in the Florida Grand Prix, February 17th at Miami. The evening finals opened with a chronological slide presentation of bodybuilding greats. The slides flipped from Grimmick and Reeves to Pearl, past Oliva and Schwarzenegger, past Zane, and concluded with Viator, Dickerson, and Padilla. And in a matter of moments, the anticipation of the audience climaxed in thunderous applause as the celluloid images became flesh and blood. For the second year in a row, big-time bodybuilding had come to Florida. Last year, the crowd sizzled as the contest between Robbie Robinson and Mike Mentzer came down to the wire. A perfect 300 score finally gave Mike the victory. This time, a similar battle took place between stoic Chris Dickerson and awesome Casey Viator. The 1980 result was even closer, as the two top both recorded 300 scores. In the end, Dickerson squeaked by with an extra first-place vote in the pose-down. But as Chris told me seconds after receiving his check for $6,000, a victory is a victory. Chris Dickerson, riding high from his convincing win at the Canada Cup, looked absolutely sensational. The symmetrical and muscular physique he displays is highlighted by the man's sheer elegance. After finishing second in his first IFBB Pro contest, the Diamond Cup, in August of 79, Chris went on to take sixth at the Olympia and first in the Canada Cup. The reasons for his impressive accomplishments were clearly evident in Miami. Dickerson looked invincible as he settled into his trademark stance on stage. Relaxed in posture, his eyes fixed straight ahead, and his face expressionless. Chris seemed to be in a state of suspended animation. He looked triumphant well in advance of the actual announcement of his victory. Still, when the announcement came, a radiant grin broke across his face, and he thrust his arms skyward in a victory salute. One thing that has characterized Chris's rise over the past 6 months is his steadily improving posing routine. With the help of Joe Weider, Chris has gradually developed a more muscular and classical routine that highlights the great symmetry of his body. Dickerson is indeed a true pro on stage. He needed all of his physical excellence in stage presentation at Miami since he was hard-pressed by Casey Viator. I can only compare the experience of seeing Viator with the way Michelangelo must have felt when he finished his Moses. So perfect was the statue that he attacked it with the chisel when it refused to speak to him. Whereas Michelangelo expected his Moses to take on human traits, one expects Casey to remain immobile, allowing the audience to devour all that it can of the marvel before it. Viator is a magnificent specimen of genetic perfection and muscular density. I had seen him at a posing exhibition last October, and his transformation since then has been unbelievable. His awesome mass is overwhelming, but upon closer examination, you realize he has excellent overall definition and polish as well. Casey's present standard is hard to believe, considering he's just returning to a sport he stood on its ear by capturing the coveted Mr. America title at age 19. What could the future hold for this marvelous athlete? Standing on stage at Miami's Dade County Auditorium, Casey seemed flawless. His massive structure was crowded with muscles, each one vying for attention. During the prejudging, I overheard someone say, "I just can't believe all that muscle. It freaks me out." Ordinarily, this would not be a memorable statement at a bodybuilding contest, but the man making it was Mike Mentzer. He had been training with Casey, and they had flown in together from L.A. Mike warned us that Casey was in the best shape of his life, 100% better than he looked at the Canada Cup. The Canadian show had been Casey's first attempt at professional competition, and he had finished a commendable fifth. I spoke with Casey before the evening finals, and he shared Mike's view. He felt he was in his best ever condition and attributed this to the rigorous diet. He had lost 15 pounds since Christmas and his heavy duty workouts with Mike. Casey's posing has also improved significantly thanks to the personal touch of Joe Weider, Viator said. With the help of people like Joe Weider, Mike Mentzer, and Bill Reynolds, nothing can stop me from going right to the top as a pro. His plan is to win the overall Grand Prix title this year. At Miami, Mike Mentzer relegated himself to the role of sideline supporter. Mike says there's a possibility he'll stay out of competition until the Olympia. He has a new book coming out in April, and he plans to be actively involved in its promotion. I gained a tremendous amount of respect for Mike in Miami. It was wonderful to watch him cheering for Casey, a man he will no doubt face one day. Pre-contest rumor mongers had Danny Padilla pegged as the man to beat. The giant killer was supposed to be ripped to shreds. When you added his usual muscle mass and perfectly balanced physique to the pitcher, how could he go wrong? Easily. Danny went on a last-minute donut binge. The orgy consisted of somewhere between 22 and 28 donuts. The number tended to rise with the succeeding accounts of the incident. Understandably, this carbohydrate calamity played havoc with his definition. However, he still looked good enough to place third. A favorite with Miami audiences, perhaps because of the large Latin attendance, Padilla teased them with his offbeat posing routine. Posing to the song, "I Don't Want to Be Lonely Tonight," he would suddenly pause, point to his incredible calves, and lip-sync the lyrics. His style on stage reveals true personality and a keen sense of humor. Danny's MO has become the center of attention during the final pose downs. He does this by casually taking center stage, stepping in front of a chief contender and displaying his muscular superiority. The crowd loves it and plays right into his hands with deepening applause. Danny claims bodybuilders under 5'3" are more huggable. In his case, I agree. The appearance of Steve Mihaylik on stage can only be described as a miracle. In 1976, on the day he was to leave for the Olympia, Steve was terribly injured in an auto truck accident, and he was told by his doctors he would never walk again, let alone step upon a posing platform. After spending 4 months on his back in a hospital, Steve went home and embarked on a slow, painful program to prove the doctors wrong. With the help of his wife, Thomasina, whom he refers to as my backbone, he worked incessantly to regain the use of his entire body. When he started training in a gym again, a dedicated training partner had to carry him from one machine to the next. Steve Mihaylik is concrete evidence of the raw determination and power of the mind over matter. 4 years after his accident, he was standing in the lineup at Miami. Just entering the contest was a tremendous personal victory for Steve. However, he was not there to do an exhibition, but to compete. At the prejudging, he looked great. A good V shape tapering into a minuscule waist, small joints, and large muscle volumes. I was sitting with Bill Reynolds at the prejudging, and Bill seemed genuinely impressed by Steve's comeback and ultimate appearance. Apparently, the judges were equally impressed because they placed Steve Mihaylik fourth. In fifth place was Boyer Coe, Mr. Consistency himself. Boyer was a little off his Mr. Olympia condition, but he told me that he likes to start out at a slightly lower level of condition and work up to a high peak for the Olympia. Few men have been competing as long as Boyer, and even fewer have remained as successful through the years. I was curious about what keeps him so enthusiastic. He told me that he gets extreme satisfaction from constantly improving, and he added, "I keep myself motivated by training with younger people and by competing frequently." I somewhat expected Ed Corney and or Carlos Rodriguez to be in the money, but the competition for the first five spots was sensational. Corney looked terrific, much improved over last year. He was tight and showed truly excellent muscularity. Watching Corney pose is a singular experience. As I sat there, overcome with goosebumps, he moved through his routine with grace and fluidity. The timing and execution of the movements were never less than perfect. He has devised an absolutely exquisite rotation of his upper torso that I have never seen before. Ed Corney considers the title of master poser a great honor, but he feels that there are others who pose as well. He's wrong. Posing is Corney's territory. As the song says, nobody does it better. And like good wine, Corney improves with age. Besides being a great bodybuilder, Carlos Rodriguez has a wonderful disposition. He seems to enjoy everything he does. Carlos used to be a rodeo rider. He no longer engages in the sport due to the danger factor, however. Now that bodybuilding is paying off for him, an injury would be out of the question. Living in Arizona and being crazy about horses, Carlos is now active in endurance riding up to 100 miles. A great deal of strategy is necessary to excel in this kind of event, and both animal and rider must be in excellent shape. Kent Keene and Annabelle Lopez completed the nine-man field. Keene, the 1977 past 40 Mr. America, and past 40 Mr. Universe winner had suffered a dislocated shoulder a week before the competition. He immediately went to Dr. Franco Colombo. Franco treated the injury effectively with acupressure, but Kent had not been able to train during that final week. Kuhn adjusted his diet and even fasted toward the end, but it simply wasn't enough. I thought he was still impressive enough, and his posing to Macho Man provided a lift to the evening program. To Annabelle No Drugs Lopez, being a competitor was as significant as winning. He looks forward to entering more of these shows and further promoting his no drug policy. On stage, he actually shouted out to the audience, "No drugs." Annabelle looks fine, but he was obviously outclassed. I asked him if the advantage his opponents had over him bothered him. "No," he said. "You see, I'd rather not risk my health. So I take no drugs whatsoever. If anyone has any doubts, I'll take a blood test, providing he's willing to make a little side bet on the results." The day of the competition in sunny Florida had started out bleak and gray. By the start of the evening finals, a cold wind had come up, but not cold enough to diminish the sparks of electricity in the air as a very excited crowd gathered in the auditorium. Slated for 7 p.m., the show actually began at 7:40, which is pretty good for Miami. Much of the audience was made up of Cubans, well known for their lack of punctuality. And as a member of that ethnic group, I explained to Karen Clark of Physique Promotions that to a Cuban, 7 o'clock really means 8 o'clock. Following the slide presentation and a few opening remarks, the contestants were individually presented. A posing exhibition by top female bodybuilder Stacy Bentley then got things rolling in high gear. Stacy had once been a short, fat girl, but the caterpillar turned into a butterfly. Stacy epitomizes what bodybuilding can do for a woman's overall physique, as well as her femininity. The crowd loved her. Putting on a contest of this caliber requires months of preparation, and the promoters are solely responsible for making a smooth and entertaining presentation out of initial chaos. Physique Productions, Wayne D'Amelia, Charles Blake, and Karen Clark, and local promoter Jorge Prince did an exceptional job. The road to the end result was a bit rocky. At one point, the contest had to be switched from one venue to another. This meant printing up new posters and tickets. However, the advanced publicity Prince was able to generate for the show helped offset the setback. Prince, a local hero, especially among Miami's Cuban populace, appeared on various television and radio programs. Muscle Builder Magazine's coverage of last year's show and a recent article previewing the Grand Prix helped attendance immeasurably. The magazine's large circulation really helped to spread the word. Also indispensable was the support of local gym owners, through which the majority of tickets were sold. Several problems emerged last year with the judging, so Bill Pearl, director of IFBB Professional Judging, was flown in to choose the panel. The panel ultimately consisted of Pearl from Pasadena, California, Roger Schwab from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Doc Neely from Atlanta, Georgia, Ernesto Milan from Miami, Florida, Rafael Guerrero from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Richard Baldwin from Tallahassee, Florida, and Robert Taylor from Miami, Florida. The contest was sponsored by Da Vinci Labs, and total prize money was $16,000. All right. And the next one comes from the next month, July of 1980, Muscle and Fitness. Everyone's a hero in Lafayette, but Casey's King of Them All by Bill Reynolds. With muscularity like a skinned rabbit, Viator roars from behind in the pose down to beat Dickerson in the Louisiana Grand Prix. Lafayette is deep in Cajun country at the southern edge of Louisiana. Flying there, one sees a series of lakes, swamps, and bogs interlaced with high spots crammed with farms and towns. Even in mid-March, which is still winter any place north of Louisiana, Lafayette is hot and incredibly humid. A five-minute walk can make your shirt feel like a wet blanket. A hearty and fun-loving people live in and around Lafayette. Most are descendants of the Acadians, a group of French settlers the British had booted out of Nova Scotia in the 19th century. Only the nearly inhospitable southern part of Louisiana offered any measurable hospitality to the Acadians, and there they settled and prospered. Due to their French ancestry, most of the people from Lafayette are Catholics. Indeed, instead of counties, Louisiana is partitioned by parishes, and most of the citizens of Acadia have large families, a factor which caused the Grand Prix promoters a headache or two. Attendance was hampered by the fact that it cost an arm and a leg to take a wife and 9 kids to a bodybuilding show. Still, the promoters made enough money to consider the show a success. The Lafayette area is noted for 2 basic exports, Tabasco sauce and great bodybuilders. The fiery hot sauce is manufactured on Avery Island, less than 30 miles to the south, from peppers grown in the area. And Boyer Coe grew up in the Lafayette, while Casey Viator comes from nearby New Iberia. Lafayette has also spawned a generation of rabid bodybuilding fans. At both the prejudging and the evening show, they loudly applauded each of the 11 contestants, and they almost blew the roof off the auditorium when Casey and Boyer posed. As Boyer commented, "With that kind of response, I should be running for mayor here." The Louisiana Grand Prix was organized locally by Bob Summer, who co-authored Coe's great new bodybuilding manual, Getting Strong, Looking Strong, and the Familiar Physique Productions team of Wayne D'Amelia, Charlie Blake, and Karen Clark provided the overall organizational framework, as they do at all the Grand Prix events. As was the case at the Florida Grand Prix, DaVinci Laboratories sponsored the competition. DaVinci kicks in $5,000 per show, which allows Physique Productions to offer the type of prize money it takes to attract the top pro bodybuilders. The motel that hosted the show's participants didn't have a central lobby, so the usual pre-competition circus was somewhat subdued. Still, the art of the brag was in fine form. "Hey, man, I'm bigger and more ripped than ever. No way I'll lose this one." You sort of get used to hearing this sort of thing before a show and after. "No way you can beat Casey in his hometown. Those judges don't know anything." And yet, the judges were as qualified as ever. Venerable Bill Pearl chaired the panel, as he does at all the professional competitions. Clarence Bass, an AAU National Physique Committee vice president, current past 40 competitor and frequent judge at the AAU Mr. America, was on the panel. So was Mike Graham, who judged the 78 America and 79 Universe. The panel also included Red Laurill, 1960 Mr. America, Hank Breaker, a gym owner from Houston, Texas, Kenny Guess, a former Mr. Louisiana, and Arlie Vest, a Yuma, Louisiana gym owner who has judged numerous AAU events in the South. Once the prejudging started, it was obvious that the battle for first would be between Viator and Chris Dickerson, as it had been a month before in Miami. Samir Benoot also looked very good, and Robbie Robinson had made a surprise entry at the last second. A few weeks before, Robbie had moved temporarily to New York City, and he told Muscle and Fitness reporter Bill Dobbins that he was tired of the pressure and grind of competition. He planned to lie low for a year and try to get his enthusiasm for training back to its 1976-1977 level. But suddenly, Robbie found the fire and at the last second decided to fly from New York to compete. While he wasn't in the black diamond condition he displayed at last year's Night of the Champions 2 at the Big Apple, Robbie was quite a bit better than he'd been at the Olympia and Canada Cup in late 79. He looked like he'd be a threat, and with every judging round, he seemed to look harder and more defined. Samir was in the best shape of his life and as hyper as ever. Four different times the morning of the contest, he called my room and asked me to come over to check out his condition, which he claimed was getting better and better. I think Samir spent most of the morning checking his cuts in the mirror in his motel room, but he was undeniably in excellent condition. Boyer Coe looked good too, certainly much better than he had a month before. It was obvious he wanted to make his best showing in front of his hometown audience. Carlos Rodriguez was a little better than he'd been in Miami, and a hard-looking Tony Emmett was a last-minute replacement for Danny Padilla. The balance of the lineup was Tom Platz, Ed Corney, Steve Mihalik, and Annabelle Lopez. Tom had missed time to speak a bit, but he still looked excellent nonetheless. Corney had slipped a little in the month between the Miami Grand Prix and the Lafayette show, as had Steve Mihalik. Lopez, on the other hand, was much improved. He looked both bigger and sharper. Returning to Dickerson and Viator, Chris looked every bit as good as he had been in Miami, but Casey had dropped about 7 pounds of fat and was literally cut to ribbons. The comparison between the two was much like the Zane Mensah showdown at last year's Olympia. It was the finely tuned, aesthetic greyhound type versus the brutally massive blockier sort. Both athletes are at the top of the list for their different body types, and both are certainly among the world's elite bodybuilders. The choice the judges panel in Lafayette had to make was not so much which contestant was the better of the two as what were the judges' physical preferences. Dickerson was as elegant as ever, and Chris, you have my apologies for overworking that word, but it's the one I must use because he looked like a Michelangelo statue come to life. Every movement was poetry, and his muscles flowed inward with each extremity in unbroken rivers of power and grace. Chris has truly taken his place among the greats of bodybuilding, and at a time in his life when most would be content to sit in front of the tube and guzzle beer. Casey, on the other hand, was equally perfect for his physical type. His unique combination of mass, density, and body proportion is as awesome and forceful as a Gulf Coast hurricane. Nonetheless, in Lafayette, he did not present himself as well as he should. With the help of Joe Weider, he's come a long way, but he still has far to go before he catches up with the onstage professionalism of Zane and Dickerson. I think, however, that he may make it in time for the Olympia. That could be the bodybuilding battle of the century, with Frank Zane trying to hold back the new onslaught of IFBB pro talent. In the first round of judging the relaxed facing poses, Viator and Dickerson both scored perfect 100s, while Samir and Robbie tied at 98. Casey had all 20s, but Chris recorded 119, which was dropped as the high and low scores were canceled out. Still, that 19 might have been a portent of the final outcome of the competition. In round two, the seven compulsory poses, front and back double bicep, front and back lat spreads, side chest, side tricep, and overhead abdominal and thigh poses, Casey and Chris again received 100 points each. Samir edged ahead of Robbie 99 to 98. The cumulative scores at that point were Viator and Dickerson both at 200, Benute 197, Robinson 196, and Cole 185. The evening show began with round three, the optional posing routine, which is choreographed to each contestant's personal music. In this round, the judging trend changed with Dickerson, Benute, and Robinson all receiving 100s, but Viator only a 99. Casey's lower score may have come because this was the only round of the first three in which the contestants appeared alone. By himself, Casey is fabulous, but next to someone, he borders on being unbelievable. The cumulative scores for the top five after round three were Dickerson 300, Viator 299, Benute 297, Robinson 296, and Co 281. Clearly, it was close between the top four, with Casey and Chris a vein and a cut above Samir and Robbie. Backstage before the pose down, Dickerson was calm and placid as usual. I've never seen a top bodybuilder so stoic when the pressure's on. Viator, in contrast, was hyped up and totally determined to wipe out Chris's one-point lead in the pose down, during which each contestant receives an extra point for each first-place vote. "I hope I get to stand next to him," Casey mumbled over and over, obviously referring to Dickerson. In the pose down, the judges placed Casey next to Chris, no doubt to be able to make final comparisons. Boom, boom, boom. Casey started hitting one fantastic shot after another. Glide, 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 Chris answered with his smooth and choreographed routine. I was watching all this from the side of the stage, wondering how a person could be asked to choose between two nearly perfect bodybuilders. But the more I watched, the more Casey seemed to stick in my mind. I think it was the newfound muscularity that did it. Finally, I decided that if I were judging, I would vote for Viator, but with great trepidation, since Chris also looked great. The tension was terrific. A 4-3 decision in Casey's favor would tie him with Chris, while a 5-2 would win it for him. Anything less in Casey's favor than these two scores, and Mr. Elegance would have wrapped up his third consecutive pro title. The scores were totaled, and the announcer began to read out the top five. Fifth place, Boyer Coe. The crowd roared its approval, and Boyer seemed genuinely happy with his placing and check. Fourth place is Robbie Robinson. A few booed, since Robbie is such a heroic figure all over America, but most of the audience agreed with the decision. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Samir jumping up and down, knowing he defeated the great Robbie, and knowing he was in third place. Third place goes to the Lion of Lebanon, Samir Benute. The Lion almost danced out on stage, happy that he placed high, and no doubt relieved that the day was over. I've seldom seen anyone so nervous and hyper for so long a time. Dickerson and Viator exchanged a solemn handshake backstage, each no doubt holding his breath. In second is Chris Dickerson. Chris, though obviously disappointed, walked calmly on stage to thank the audience and take his check. Casey had gone bounding off into the darkness at the very back of the stage, yelling, "All right, all right, all right." And first place, originally from New Iberia and now living in Santa Monica, California, is Casey Viator. As Casey strutted out, as massive as a mountain and as ripped as a skinned rabbit, the crowd went wild as he repeated his awesome winning routine. Then he took his $6,000 check and was surrounded by family and friends. Yes, sir, Casey Viator was a popular winner in Lafayette, Louisiana. In conclusion, John Balick and I would like to thank two individuals who were most helpful to the muscle and fitness contingent at the Louisiana Grand Prix. The first of these is Johnny Hines, a national rodeo champion in bareback bronc riding in 1962. A few years later, he became an oil tycoon. The weekend of the show, he was always handy with his $150,000 motorhome to drive all the contestants and officials wherever they needed to go. Red LaRille, one of the judges and a local gym owner, gad, what a gym, 7 acres of it. And Red's wife had an open house between the prejudging and the evening show. Believe me, Miss LaRille's crawfish etouffee is out of this world. Following the competition, I noticed Casey and his father adding up the Grand Prix total points for the first two shows. To qualify for the Olympia this year, Casey needs to win the overall points race. With him and Dickerson both having a first and a second in the first two contests, they are currently tied at 29 points apiece. After a very good show in Lafayette, it's on to Santa Monica, home of the champions. Good job, Casey. And they've also got the scores here all broken down for the Louisiana Grand Prix, which I love that they did that. Great pictures in this magazine, too. Amazing. All right. The next one comes from the August 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness, 1 month later. It says the California Grand Prix, duel in the sun, gunfight at the OK Corral, the pro bodybuilding shootout comes to Santa Monica by Bill Dobbins. There's something different about a professional Grand Prix show. No milling about of nervous, wide-eyed kids trembling with anticipation at getting on stage to vie for local, state, or regional titles. No noise, confusion, and last-minute rushing around trying to find a missing competitor. Neither is there the intense pressure and expectation of the Mr. Olympia, where the eyes of the world are on the outcome, and the winner will be crowned as the best bodybuilder on earth. There are no crews from the television networks and no representatives of the international press. Instead, what you have is backstage is a group of professionals going about their business in a professional manner. These are experienced, mature competitors. Rodriguez, Waller, Emmett, Viator, they've all been here before. Robinson, Dickerson, Coe, and Benute are no strangers to high-level competition. Bill Grant is more at home on stage than off, and Ed Giuliani has been competing since before some of the aforementioned ever picked up a weight. There's plenty of excitement out in front of the audience, however. A multitude shows up for the prejudging, and the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium is jammed for the evening show. Southern California gets its share of bodybuilding events throughout the year, but this is the one chance to see the top professionals. A preview, perhaps, of the 1980 Mr. Olympia contest. After all, how many of these fans will be able to afford a trip to Australia? Earlier in the day, head judge Bill Pearl had gathered the other judges together and gave them their guidelines. Let's have no conversations among ourselves about the competitors' physiques, guys, he told them. Every judge should make up his own mind, without consultation, okay? With a panel including judges like Franco Colombo, Brad Harris, Dan Howard, Leo Stern, Bill Drake, and Mr. Olympia himself, Frank Zane, not a lot of explanation was necessary. But Pearl was thorough, and he made sure there would be no misunderstandings. He told them, one, they would be given scorecards and would hold these up for each competitor at the end of each round. These would keep everybody, spectators and competitors, informed on how things stood at all times. Two, there would be four rounds, the first two taking place in the afternoon and the last two at the evening show. The first round, competitors standing relaxed, judged on overall appearance and physique, including appropriateness of posing trunks, haircut, skin tone, and the like. The second round, each competitor performing 7 compulsory poses, after which the judges would call them back by twos to make comparisons, but only in those particular poses. The third round, free posing, each competitor doing his own routine, judged on presentation and stage presence. The fourth round, the pose down of the top 5, during which the judges would choose a competitor for first place. Number 3, the person judged best by each judge in each round was to be given 20 points. Somebody had to get a 20 each time, but the judges could award more than one bodybuilder 20 points if he felt they were equal. 4, each competitor had to be given a score each round from 20 on down. In point of fact, 15 would be the lowest score awarded, and there weren't many of those. There was only one item Pearl brought up that was somewhat out of the ordinary. Bill Grant had requested permission to use a fog machine to create a floor-level mist during his third round presentation. Should that be allowed? The promoters passed the decision on to the competitors. Pearl and Wayne D'Amelia gathered them together in the dressing room and explained the situation. This could open a real can of worms, Pearl said, If a competitor who used something like this was in a close battle for first, it could decide the contest. It was difficult to have adequate debate on the subject on such short notice, so the others generously voted, with only Rodriguez and Benute against, to let Grant go ahead. After all, he had already gone to the trouble and expense of bringing in the equipment and a man to operate it. So they stepped out on stage for the first round of prejudging. The audience was appreciative and enthusiastic. Robbie and Samir stood side by side. In spite of the fact that they were supposed to be posing relaxed, Samir tensed and flexed his triceps. Robbie saw him, grinned, and did the same thing. They kept this up for quite a while as if they were doing a little dance, a bodybuilding pas de deux. The scores were shown, and there were a few surprises. A pleasant one for Robbie was the number of 20s awarded him. Franco, Brad Harris, Zane all gave him the top number. Pearl gave him a 19. Good scores. Robbie's spirits picked up immensely. He smiled a lot backstage, laughed, and joked. "I'll tell you, Bill," he said to me, "I'm just glad to be here. I love competing, and I've missed it. I really don't care that much about winning tonight. I'm not in my absolute best shape, but I'm really enjoying being a part of this." And he did look good, better than at the Olympia. All he seemed to be lacking was just a few more cuts. Dan Howard didn't see it that way, however, and he gave him a 17 for the first round, which just goes to show you how subjective contest scoring can be. All eyes were on the shootout between Casey Viator and Chris Dickerson. Power versus grace, density versus symmetry. A confrontation much like the Olympia contest between Mensah and Zane. Dickerson had emerged victorious in Florida, only to lose to Casey in Louisiana. The scoring system called for throwing out the highest and lowest marks. When this was done, Chris emerged with 520s, a perfect 100. Obviously, he was the man to beat. Samir Benute was disappointed with himself. "3 days ago, I was perfect, cut to ribbons. Tonight, the frame, the structure, and the symmetry were there, but not the cuts. He had missed it by 3 days, peaked that much too early. As I've said before, if it were that easy to peak perfectly, everyone could do it." The second round was more of the same. Robbie continued to do well, and Chris emerged with another perfect 100. Perfect meaning, of course, that he received all 20s, not that he was judged as having no faults at all. Casey was behind overall, but not in every scorecard. Pearl and Frank Zane stood out in the parking lot after the prejudging, and I asked Bill how he saw it. "I've got Chris and Casey dead even," he said. "It's up in the air as far as I'm concerned." As the evening show began, there were some problems. Chris Dickerson was first on stage for free posing, and his tape was evidently miscued, tuned to the wrong side or something. It took a couple of tries to get it right, and Chris was steaming. But to his credit, he did not let it interfere with his presentation, and he was calm and apologetic when he came off stage. A lot of self-control there. As if this wasn't enough, the tape machine then broke down, forcing MC Mario Machado to fill in some time while the fault was investigated. Mario introduced Arnold in the audience, but Arnold wasn't there. He was delayed by a late rehearsal for the Jane Mansfield story, the movie for which he's appearing. Mario was steady as a rock, however, and handled the confusion as well as possible. In a few minutes, the fault in the recorder was fixed, and the show continued. When it came time for Bill Grant to pose, a barrel of dry ice was wheeled out to the wings. A hose extended, and he appeared surrounded by a low-lying cloud. It was a nice effect. The only problem was it went on too long. 4 musical selections. The mist all but dissipated, and the audience bored. A minute of this would have been ideal, but 3 minutes plus was just too much. Robbie again got a good response. At the beginning of the evening show, there had been a slideshow of history of bodybuilding, and the 3 bodybuilders who received the most enthusiastic response were Steve Reeves, Arnold, a howl of recognition, and Robbie. Backstage, Boyer Coe explained that he's come to appreciate Zane's feeling that you can only peak once a year. Show after show, up against the same competitors, it's a lot harder to really get excited and to discipline yourself to be in the best shape. "I'm on a program designed to bring me to perfection for the Olympia this fall," he said. "Actually, I'd prefer these contests to be spaced differently. Say 3 in a row and then a long break. Trying to be in shape every few weeks is a terrible strain on the system." Boyer also commented that he thought some excitement could be added if the Grand Prix events were held in conjunction with a good amateur contest, a Mr. California, for example. This way you could have the local hungry young amateurs and the seasoned professionals on the same bill. Thus, the audience would really get their money's worth. Mike Mensah was backstage with brother Ray. He was not competing, he explained, because of other commitments. I have a book coming out and promoting it is taking a lot of time. So I'm just going to save myself for the Olympia. After the free posing, the five finalists were announced. In order of scoring, they were 1, Chris Dickerson, 2, Robbie Robinson, 3, Casey Viator, 4, Samir Banoot, 5, Boyer Coe. In the pose down, each judge is asked to pick one competitor for first place. These first place votes are added to the competitors' scores from the earlier judging. At Santa Monica, 6 of the 7 judges picked Chris Dickerson for first place in the pose down. Thus, Dickerson was the champion, scoring 306 total points. Robinson finished 2nd, Viator 3rd, Banoot 4th, and Coe 5th. Later, I talked to John Balick, the local promoter for the California Grand Prix, about some of the problems he had encountered putting on the show. I asked him for some suggestions as to how the promoters could avoid similar pitfalls. You learn a lot doing a show like this, he explained. That law that says that anything that can go wrong will is absolutely correct. For instance, we went to the best audio supplier in Hollywood and got their best unit. It cost a lot of money, but that didn't keep it from breaking down. In the future, I'd probably opt for at least one backup machine and probably a professional sound technician to be on hand to troubleshoot. Another difficulty was the fact that 5 bodybuilders who were under contract to the show canceled out. We can't have this happen anymore. The audience has paid to see them, and we should give them their money's worth. I think if a bodybuilder under contract doesn't show up and doesn't have a legitimate excuse, the IFBB should levy a fine or perhaps even suspend that person. That would ensure that people live up to their commitments. So that was the California Grand Prix, a show that proved beyond a doubt that among such highly developed competitors, presentation is becoming more and more important. It also raised the question of whether props and special techniques should be used by competitors as part of their free posing presentation. Having seen what Bill Grant made of this, I have a suggestion. The 3rd round is supposed to show how you present your physique. In that context, any special effects can only distract and confuse the judges in their evaluation. Instead of special effects, since these shows are for entertainment, why not produce special segments? Opening the evening show, for example, or resuming the show after the intermission by using the skill of the bodybuilders together with lighting and other effects to really give the audience something special to look at. That would seem to be the time for fog machines and such, not during the actual contest. Also, I have one criticism of the show that has nothing to do with the contestants or the promoters, but with the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. I staged the 1977 Mr. America contest there, and I've been involved with some Muhammad Ali boxing promotions there, so I know the place pretty well. The backstage crew is great, and I've never had any trouble with the actual running of the event, but the people out front in charge of things like concession stands are not to be believed. For example, just before intermission at the Santa Monica Grand Prix, I went back to the lobby to get a cup of coffee before the rush, and I found out that all the stands had closed up for the night, and it wasn't even 9:30. Somehow the people who run the concession stands had gotten the impression that there would be no intermission. I told the man in charge that he was mistaken, but he just made a rude remark and walked off. Promoters ought to make sure that this is not going to happen when they do a show. The whole audience at the Grand Prix went out into the lobby and found nothing there to eat or drink. A lot of people left because of this. Gold's Gym is going to stage this year's Mr. America at the Civic Auditorium, and they ought to put on some pressure to make sure these lapses don't happen again. Other promoters should also take heed. Even at last year's Olympia, I saw some officious ass of an assistant manager refuse to let Danny Padilla in the front door. Danny ignored him and just kept going. The promoters of the event should see to it that their audience is not inconvenienced by any of these people. Professional bodybuilding and amateur bodybuilding is going big time. So are the prices. The audience expect their money's worth, and they will have to get it or they'll stop coming. All right. It's interesting that, of course, nobody knew Arnold was going to do the Olympia this year, and everybody was looking at these shows as warm-ups for the Olympia, and they were thinking it was going to be like Dickerson and Zane and, of course, Casey and Mensur, Boyer, and then, of course, we know what happened. All right. This next article is the next month, September 1980, so this is right before the Olympia. Viator Supreme and Steel City by Bill Reynolds, editor-in-chief. They like them rugged in Pittsburgh. Fittingly, Casey scores a come-from-behind victory at the Pennsylvania Grand Prix. Pittsburgh has a macho image, rugged men forging steel for the nation, then boisterously quaffing beers when the day is done. After all, Pittsburgh does have the world's toughest football team, appropriately named the Steelers. Pittsburgh is also a major stop on the IFBB Pro Bodybuilding Grand Prix circuit, And after last year's titanic struggle between Robbie Robinson and Mike Mentzer, hordes of fans from Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia look forward to the 1980 Pennsylvania Grand Prix. Interestingly enough, local promoter Sam Yerrick and the familiar Physique Productions team, Wayne D'Amelia, Charles Blake, and Karen Clark, chose Casey Viator for a week's pre-contest publicity. With his rugged physique and a great physical power, Casey was a huge hit everywhere he went, no doubt because so many bodybuilders in this rough, tough city could identify with him. Equally popular was Stacey Bentley, who flew in a couple days before the show. She would be a guest poser to do a little last-minute promotional work. A combination of gentle femininity and lean, hard muscle, Stacey reflects the rapid rise of women's bodybuilding in America. In a memorable half hour at Jim Mannion's Nautilus and Weight Training Center in Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Stacey totally mesmerized the local television reporters present. After the resulting nightly television news coverage of her, a significant share of the audience came to the Syria Mosque near Pittsburgh University just to see Stacey glide and glow through her two-minute routine. Back to Casey. The man goes through an ordeal every time he readies himself for competition, and it's remarkable how calmly he can do his promotional work in the face of such a struggle. Definition does not come easily to Viator, and his diet has to be brutally tight. Casey has a great deal of trouble with excess water retention, so every morsel of food has to be evaluated for the sodium content. Despite his promotional and dietary travails, Viator rapidly improved during the week he was in Pittsburgh. At the Cross Gates Inn on the day before the contest, he displayed his abs to a group of muscle fans assembled in the lobby. The fans roared approval. Casey looked very ready. At the prejudging, Viator was joined by 10 other top IFBB pro champions. I got my first look that weekend at Chris Dickerson and noted that he had re-achieved his usual remarkable condition. A short time before, while winning the World Couples Championship with Stacey Bentley, he had looked somewhat smooth. Clearly, Chris had worked some sort of magic between the two shows, and just as clearly, he and Casey would go down to the wire for a fourth straight time on the Grand Prix circuit. But there was Roy Callender and Robbie Robinson to make the usual two-man show a little more interesting. Callender had phoned me about 5 a.m. 2 weeks before to tell me he was making a comeback at the Pennsylvania Grand Prix. As sleepy as I was, I noted that the phone connection was as clear as a bell. "You must be in L.A., I mumbled. "No, I'm in Germany," LeGrand Roy said. "I've been in Stuttgart for 2 months training with Josef Wilkosch." The phone connection was so clear that I didn't believe Callender until he put Josef on the line. Apparently, Roy had suffered for nearly 2 months from his pre-Olympia back problem. Then he went to Barbados for Christmas, and a Dr. Seeley there worked on his back with chiropractic manipulations. Gradually, Roy's back improved, and by the end of January, he was training as hard as ever. Callender and Wilkosch had become pretty good friends at the World Gym in Santa Monica while each prepared for the Lorimer Schwarzenegger extravaganza last fall in Columbus, Ohio. They trained well together in California, so Roy decided to fly to Stuttgart to train with Josef again. The partnership obviously worked well. At Pittsburgh, Roy was in fantastic shape, markedly better than his form last year at the Pro Universe, where he'd been in the best condition of his life. This time, the huge muscles were there as usual, but the cuts were deeper than ever. There were cross striations in the quads and cuts like I've never seen before running up and down his hamstrings. Clearly, Roy would be right in there. Dickerson has been described by this writer so many times this year that it's difficult to draw the picture any more clearly. Suffice it to say that he was in his customary superb condition. Chris was equal to the shape he'd been in for the last four or five competitions, and almost up to where he'd been at the 79 Canada Cup. In essence, he's a living, breathing statue. Robbie has kept improving all year, although he has yet to win a competition. At Pittsburgh, he still wasn't as cut as he should be, but he's apparently saving himself for shows later in the year. But if he lacked cuts, Robbie had mass enough for any hardcore bodybuilding fan. At 5'8", he's not that big of a man, but you could tell me he has 21.5-inch arms, and I'd believe you. Almost everyone at the Syria Mosque would as well. The crowd cheered his every move with lusty abandon. And Robbie smiled so often that the posing light almost continually glinted off his gold tooth. Boyer Coe was in there again, and it just boggles my mind to think how many shows this man enters each year. And he always looks good, as evidenced by the fact that he hasn't placed out of the top five at a competition since 1968. And since 1976, he has entered every IFBB Pro competition except the 79 Pro Universe, which conflicted with a longstanding promise to guest pose at a show promoted by a friend. Ed Corney looked pretty tight, although he wasn't as good as he had been at the Florida Grand Prix. The master poser seldom misses a show either, which amazes everyone who knows that he's rapidly moving out of his mid-40s and approaching the magic half-century mark. It wouldn't surprise me to see Eddie still competing and improving at 50. Samir Benoot looked good, although he was a shade below his Louisiana and California Grand Prix shape. Like Viator, Samir has been having problems with water retention. He looked super on the plane to Pittsburgh, but the dehumidified air of the cabin dried him out too much. Then Samir had to eat and drink, so he was a bit smooth when only hours before he had the Olympian cuts. Bill Grant was in his all-time best condition, or very close to it. The announcer reads Bill's complete press biography at the evening show. Bill is playing hard on his image as the world's sexiest bodybuilder. He's also doing more and more film work lately, and he's obviously still finding time to train hard. Tom Platz, who used to live in the Pittsburgh area, was extremely popular with the audience. It's hard to believe that this Herculean athlete, tipping the Toledos at 200 to 210 in good shape, weighed only 160 pounds at the 77 Mr. America competition. Tom's authoring a course on upper body mass and power. It will describe in detail how he brought his body, particularly his torso and arms, up to their present exalted level. After missing the California Grand Prix, Annabel Lopez, who likes to be called Al, was back. He's improving rapidly. Al has an aesthetic, albeit light build, and he displays it very well. He issues the use of drugs, and he pays a price in his placing because of this. But to him, his health and family are far more important than a new trophy. Rounding out the field was Tony Emmett, and I personally can't understand how he fails to place in the top echelon at each pro show. He has a great physique, although it perhaps lacks some of the aesthetic lines associated with the real superstars of the sport. Tony has beaten the well-known Serge Nubre, as well as a host of other champions. And at 41, he's as good as he's ever been. The judging panel was also headed by the widely respected Bill Pearl. Also on the panel were Dr. Charles Simkovich, Robin Perilla, Ken Vega, Jim Mannion, Dick Reeder, and Dennis Isidore. In round one, standing relaxed, Viator and Dickerson predictably received perfect 100 scores. Looking a bit subdued and lacking his usual wide grin, Callender got a 99, Robbie scored a 98, Coe and Benoot 91s, Corney a 90, Platz 89, Grant and Emmett 88s, and Lopez 84. Callender, Viator, and Dickerson all received 100s in round two, and I felt Callender looked the best here. He's very strong on the compulsory poses. Robbie hung in there with the 99, and then from there on down, it was Coe with 95, Benoot 93, Grant 91, Corney 90, Emmett 90, Platz 86, and Lopez 86. The free posing round was held at the evening show. The 100 scores went to Dickerson, Callender, and an inspired Eddie Corney. Coe and Robinson both received 99s, and Viator slipped to 98. The rest of the scores were Grant 96, Emmett 94, Benoot 94, Platz 90, and Lopez 88. After the three IFBB judging rounds, Dickerson looked to be in a commanding position with 300 points. Callender was second at 299, Viator third at 298, Robinson fourth at 296, and Coe fifth at 285. In position 6 through 11th were Corney with 280, Benoot 278, Grant 275, Emmett 272, Platz 265, and Lopez 258. After the first three rounds, you probably would have found it impossible to get 5-1 odds from anyone that Viator would take the overall title. Well, maybe you could have received such odds from Casey himself, because he undoubtedly remembered coming from behind to defeat Dickerson at the Louisiana Grand Prix. Callender and Robbie were there to complicate things, particularly Le Grand Roy, who lodged firmly in second place. After his subdued first two rounds of posing, Roy had come dramatically alive in round three. He had plenty of audience support going into the final pose down, and since he trailed Dickerson by only 1 point, it was possible he could win. Since you can pick up only one extra point per first place vote in round four, Robbie looked like a long shot. With 296, he'd have to beat Dickerson 6-1 to win. It didn't seem likely. The pose down started with a thunderous roar from the crowd. The intensity had to be similar to the Battle of Waterloo, with cannons were blasting on all sides. and it would certainly be a Waterloo for 10 of the 11 hopeful champions. Finally, the top five were announced. In fifth place, intoned the announcer, Boyer Co. The decision was popular with the audience, but drew an expected grumble from the contestants placing below Co. Fourth place is Robbie Robinson. That announcement drew a few boos from the audience, but Robbie was an image of grateful acceptance. He bowed deeply to the judges and audience, and then, smiling broadly, he left the stage with his check. Third place, Roy Callender. Roy, too, was all smiles. Perhaps he felt he could have placed higher, but not a hint of it showed in his face. Only Roy, Frank Zane, Robbie Robinson, Casey Viator, Mike Mentzer, and Chris Dickerson have won IFBB Pro titles in 1979 and 1980. Roy travels in elite company. Second, God, the tension. Chris Dickerson. There were scattered boos as a disappointed Chris took his check, chin up as usual. Dickerson's remarkable string of first and second place finishes have won him a host of new fans. And of course, Casey Viator took home that $5,000 check for first place. He had defeated Dickerson 5-2 in the pose down round to win 303-302. Only Bill Pearl and Dennis Isidore had picked Dickerson in round four. The other five judges picked Viator, who vaulted from third to first as a result. The victory tied him with Dickerson at two Grand Prix victories apiece. Wow, that was cool. Man, I really liked how they used to do these things with the three rounds of judging, and it was cool how Corny moved up for his posing round, and Roy Callender moved up. That was really cool how they used to do it. All right, last one is November 1980. Now, I believe the Olympia was probably history by the time this magazine came out, but this is the report of the Night of the Champions, of course, which was the final event on the Grand Prix Tour. It took place in New York, and the title of the article is Last Stop New York. Chris Dickerson rings down the curtain on the 1980 Grand Prix season with a victory, which gives him the overall Grand Prix championship, and this was also written by Marilyn Guzman. New York, New York, the Big Apple, proclaimed by many to be the most exciting city in the world. Undoubtedly, no other city could be more appropriate than this Petropolis as a place to hold one of the most prestigious events in bodybuilding, the Night of the Champions 3, the Grand Prix Finals. This culmination of the Grand Prix Tour would provide not only the New York Grand Prix winner, but also the overall Grand Prix champion. Broadway, the lights, the glitter, the tingle, the anticipation. Such was the atmosphere at the Beacon Theater on the evening of May 10th, as nearly 3,000 enthusiastic fans filled the orchestra pit, main floor, two balconies, and every other crevice that could possibly accommodate a human being. Despite the fact that seats for the show had been sold out for a week, there were 2,000 fans clamoring for standing room only tickets the day of the show. It was worth every effort, however, to gain entry into this event. An exceptional field gathered on stage for what would become one of the toughest battles in the annuals of sport. Consider the top five. Ed Corny was ripped to shreds and looked better than ever before, which prompted a raft of 20s for his perfect free posing routine. True excellence. Roy Callender was massive and defined. Again, true excellence. Robbie Robinson displayed his monumental physique with consummate dignity. And finally, there were Chris Dickerson and Casey Viator. Would this be another head-to-head battle for first between the two of them, as had been the case in the four preceding Grand Prix shows? The final pose down between these five giants caused an uproar. The scene became even more frenetic than when Roy Callender deliberately positioned himself between Dickerson and Robinson for closer comparison. It was an unbelievable lineup of muscle greats, and the judges had their hands full selecting the best among the fabulous five. The final decision, Chris Dickerson prevailed again. Winning the $5,000 check for first place, Dickerson also became the undisputed 1980 overall Grand Prix champion, an accomplishment for which he received a commemorative ring valued at more than $5,000 and the prized Joe Weider bronze sculpture trophy. Chris won the overall title by placing first in Miami, Santa Monica, and New York, and second in Lafayette and Pittsburgh. One can't help but admire the dedication and determination exemplified by this superb athlete. I asked Chris how he managed to achieve such a near-perfect peak for each show. He explained, rather than peaking, I just tried to stay consistent with my training and diet to remain at or near peak form throughout the entire series. but it still took tremendous mental effort to gear up for every contest. The constant physical strain and unyielding pressure were scarcely evident as Dickerson accepted the compliments for his double triumph, and I'm sure he meant every word when he exclaimed, "I feel fantastic." Now Chris looks forward to a rest from the grueling schedule of the last few months. Then he will begin to gear up for the Mr. Olympia contest, where he hopes to reach his highest peak of the year. Rounding out the top five positions in the final standings were Robbie Robinson second, Roy Callender third, Ed Corney fourth, and Casey Viator fifth. I had seen Casey at the Miami show a few months earlier, and while he proved to be just as impressive in New York, he seemed a little worn from the five-show Grand Prix grind. But such fatigue is understandable, because no group of top bodybuilders has been asked to peak five times in 3.5 months before this year. It's tough. Viator had placed among the top three at the previous four Grand Prix events, so he had been first in two of the shows. So his slip to fifth at New York was very unexpected, and I might add, unpopular with the audience. Due to his almost shockingly huge and dense physique, Casey has been more affected than any other competitor by the radical differences in what judging panels prefer to see. The psychological load on all of this was undoubtedly weighing heavily on him. Regarding the Grand Prix experience as a whole, he remarked, "I had no idea it would be such a mental and physical ordeal to compete in all five shows. I did, however, learn two things. First, how to pose effectively and relate to the audience better. And second, how to peak properly. I'm just glad it's over." In his first year of the IFBB competition, Casey Viator has left no doubt how he stands in bodybuilding's firmament. He has established himself as a champion and has joined the ranks of the superstars. Yet he's only just begun. "Corny, corny, corny." Such was the chant as the master poser stepped out on stage. One actually had a gasp as Corny, looking like an anatomy chart, went through his relaxed and compulsory poses at the prejudging. And in the evening, the adulation doubled as he performed flawlessly to the sounds of "My Way." As Ed, who was in the best condition of his career, did his free posing routine, I sat there like everyone else with all the symptoms: goosebumps, chills, the works. When it was over, the audience gave this man the standing ovation he undisputably deserved. Roy Callender had placed third in Pittsburgh a few weeks earlier. The fact that he was further improved for the New York show had him projected as a possible winner. To say he looked impressive is an understatement. With overwhelming size and precise proportions, he was nothing short of spectacular. And although he claimed that he hadn't dieted stringently for this competition or the last one, he displayed a remarkable degree of muscular definition. 5 days before last year's Olympia, Roy hurt his back while training with Arnold Schwarzenegger in Santa Monica, but now the injury seems to be totally healed. Roy continues to live in Canada, but is considering a move to California. He finds that training in California's supercharged bodybuilding atmosphere, as well as the balmy climate, is very beneficial. Last but not least, the announcer said at the start of the prejudging, contestant number 16, Robbie Robinson. That brought out the Black Prince in all his muscle armor, stepping onto what had become a crowded stage. With virtually no remaining space, Robbie had to stand at the very edge against a dark backdrop with little available light. Needless to say, this occurrence was totally unintentional, but Robbie decided to have some fun with it by playing hide-and-seek in the lineup. The crowd loved it. When he finally appeared center stage in full frontal view, it was mass hysteria time, and Robbie flashed that famous smile of his. Although it was clear that Robbie was fully enjoying himself, he was there on serious business, and he was obviously well prepared. He was big, he was cut, and his posing was better than ever. And upon striking his signature side chest shot, Robbie displayed abdominal and intercostal definition unequaled in sport. I spoke with Robbie briefly following the evening finals, and he seemed pleased with the results. As for his future plans, they revolve around his bodybuilding camp in Marina Del Rey, California. Will he compete again this year? He'll play it by ear. The Olympia? He has no definite plans of entering, but he's open to the idea. Could Robbie be mellowing? Despite one of the most successful and consistent careers in professional bodybuilding, Boyer Coe was not among the top finalists. In an unsurpassed achievement, Boyer had finished in the top five at each of the seven shows he entered last year. And he had continued that streak in 1980 right up to the New York show. The sixth Boyer got here exemplified the toughness of this competition, because he was in his usual sparkling condition. Earlier in the evening, Boyer joined his wife, Valerie, in a fantastically choreographed dual posing routine that enhanced the show tremendously. On his impression of New York, bodybuilding's Iron Cowboy, Carlos Rodriguez, said he felt like a fish out of water. Even though the Big Apple used to be home to Carlos, he obviously settled into the comfortable pace of his present Arizona lifestyle. Although Carlos managed to keep himself in excellent shape throughout the Grand Prix series, I know he's capable of attaining an even more heightened degree of condition, which would put him closer to the winner's circle. Sitting in one of those renowned New York delis after the contest, Carlos relished the thought of simply messing around with his horses, or maybe even doing a little rodeo riding during the break between the Grand Prix season and the Big O. But mainly he felt it would be nice to take it easy for a while. I continue to be awed by Steve Mihaylik. This man is simply unreal. Almost killed in an accident 4 years ago, he has returned to excellent condition. But in New York, he looks slightly worn, as if the hectic schedule of these shows had taken its toll. Besides his training, Steve runs one of the most successful gyms in the New York area, Mr. America's Gym in Farmingdale on Long Island. And with regard to his unique circumstances, he's still in severe pain from his injuries when he's training. I hope he's not pushing himself too hard and too quickly. Yet I have no doubt that this man, a winner in every sense of the word, will reach each goal he sets for himself, for he has already proven that no obstacle is too big for him to overcome. Bill Grant claims to be the sexiest bodybuilder around, but he was looking a lot more than just sexy in New York. I had seen him last year in Miami and more recently on his Toyota television commercial. But when I saw Bill on stage in New York, he was more impressive than ever. Bill has improved every body part, including his calves. He still has the most incredibly developed glutes in the sport, and his posing dancing routine gets every audience going. Bill Grant has rhythm, charisma, and is he sexy? International flavor was added by the likes of Samir Benoot, Mohamed Makawe, and Tony Emmett. Tony and his wife had just returned from an extended European tour. Tony's typical English personality makes him very calm and relaxed competitor, totally devoid of the aggressiveness displayed by most of the Americans. It'll be interesting to see if this personality changes as Tony spends more time in the U.S. Samir Benoot's symmetrical structure is all that reports have made it out to be. A newcomer to the pro ranks, he lacks the experience of some of the more seasoned competitors. However, there's no doubt that with his wealth of natural advantages, he's going to be a major factor on the pro scene. The Lion of Lebanon was perturbed that he miscalculated his peak. On the plane yesterday, I was so ready I could have exploded right through the roof, he moaned before the prejudging. After landing, however, I felt myself starting to lose it. Egypt's Mohamed Makawe is comparable to some of his country's magnificent monuments. He's quiet and subdued, which gives him an aura of mystery. One senses in him an underlying strength and unmistakable self-assurance. In conversation, I discovered that Mohamed is a man of numerous talents, which include being fluent in several languages. In fact, he used to work as an interpreter for the Egyptian Olympic Committee. Mohamed had just spent some time training in Stuttgart, Germany. Both he and Roy Callender trained at the same gym there, but not simultaneously. And he arrived in America looking like a strong contender. His overall structure consists of long, elegant muscles and not typical on men of his short stature. And highly symmetrical as he was, I couldn't help but notice his exceptional deltoid and forearm development. After the contest, Mohamed moved to California with his wife and young son. He plans to study fine arts at UCLA and eventually wants to become a cartoonist. Mohamed already has 3 years' experience as a creative designer in the advertising industry back in Egypt. Tom Platz entered the competition with admittedly less than top condition, with other things such as an imminent trip to Europe for exhibitions and seminars preoccupying him. Tom approached his competition with less than Olympian single-mindedness, but he was very impressive nonetheless. There's no doubt that Tom was bigger than ever, a true example of Herculean mass. And when he chisels it down for the Big O, he's going to be someone to contend with. As he puts it, the Olympia is the one contest I die for. Here I come to save the day. Everyone is familiar with the Mighty Mouse cartoon theme. It was the song that Anabel Lopez, the non-steroid man, used to open his routine in New York, and people loved it. Anabel looked better than I've ever seen him. His way may be different, but he works as hard as anyone, and the results are obvious. He's also proven himself to be a gutsy individual, a man with his own ideas and ideals, plus the fire to see them through. At the same time, he has a keen sense of humor. A legendary figure from the mid-60s, Harold Poole, continued his comeback. His previous titles include Mr. America and Mr. Universe, and he was second to Larry Scott twice at the Olympia. Poole returned to the platform last year at the Canada Cup, and his appearance in New York indicates that he plans to stick with the comeback. Bodybuilding has altered so drastically since the 60s, however, that it's difficult to simply come back. Harold's physique, although visually pleasing, lacks the overall polish and sophistication that the judges have become accustomed to in recent years. Watching Harold Poole, one felt a sense of nostalgia as well as a certainty that he could one day be back up there. Watching Tommy Abar, who decided to return to competition at the Night of the Champions after a 12-year hiatus, one felt a sense of embarrassment. The man was a long way from championship condition, and he didn't belong on that stage at a contest of such stature. As an added attraction to the show, a 16-woman bodybuilding club called the Physiques gave a well-choreographed group posing exhibition, which the audience loved. These women, directed by Susan Fry, come from the mainline Nautilus facility in Philadelphia. Susan deserves the highest praise for the group's precise coordination of movement, especially considering the number of people involved. In all respects, the Night of the Champions 3 was an extraordinary success. Special attention was given to every detail, including the judging procedure. Although the IFBB judging system was employed, a discussion on the sanctity of a 20 was led by Roger Schwab, an assistant to Bill Pearl, head of the pro judging for the IFBB. The conference, which included the officials and all the contestants, dealt with the fact that a perfect score, which up to then had been commonly awarded, would not be treated as casually at this show. Schwab explained that a perfect score was just that, complete with its due significance and the rarity of its use. Thus, it was decided that each judge would be allowed to award only 120 per round. This added a great deal of suspense and excitement to the final judging round, because during the first two rounds, scores were sufficiently close to make the evening round decisive. The extremely difficult and thankless task of judging was in the hands of the most capable panel of judges, headed by Schwab and Winston Roberts, another of Bill Pearl's assistants and a judge at the 1977, 1978, and 1979 Mr. Olympia contest. The panel included Dr. Kimoyne Voyages, a former bodybuilding champion, Dom Serto, former New Jersey AFAB president, Tommy Pizzocco, former Mr. New Jersey, George Payne, America's Most Muscular Man title winner in the 50s, Cliff Sawyer, New England AAU official, and John Colacioni, who served as secretary. The benefits of a production such as this and other Grand Prix shows are reaped by the bodybuilders as well as by the fans. Professional bodybuilding has grown in leaps and bounds, and now it joins extensive television coverage. The 79 Olympia was telecast by CBS, and the New York show was fully taped by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation for a segment on its version of 60 Minutes. Responsibility for the success of the pro shows always rests with those behind the scenes. I would like to congratulate Wayne D'Amelia, Charlie Blake, and Karen Clark, the members of the Physique Productions, for all their organizational and promotional work on the Grand Prix Series. They have become the promotional royalty of pro bodybuilding. Their talent and dedication seems limitless, and they deserve the plaudits of all of us. Ditto to Da Vinci Labs for their sponsorship of these wonderful shows. What the future holds is unknown, but I had the honor of meeting and speaking with IFBB President Ben Weider, who sees bodybuilding continuing its upward growth pattern. He projects at least 8 Grand Prix shows for the next year, and he expects that the prize money for all IFBB pro shows in 81 will exceed $300,000. New York, New York. If I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. In the Big Apple, people expect the best, and it takes genuine courage to stand up for their scrutiny. If the people at the Beacon Theater were for you, it was like riding a perfect wave, smooth, gradually building to a crescendo. If they were against you, the ride was rather bumpy. By evening's end, it was apparent that all the spectators were more than satisfied by what they seen. Unfortunately, while most of them settled for programs, T-shirts, and autographs as souvenirs, some decided that a spotlight used by the CBS television crew, a few dumbbells, and my legal pad were better reminders of a good show. But I guess that sort of thing goes with the territory. All right. Hope you guys enjoyed that. The Grand Prix shows from 1980. And it's kind of sad when you realize how many of those people that we read about have now passed on. Chris Dickerson, Casey Viator, Steve Mihalik, Carlos Rodriguez, Ed Corney, of course. We still have Roy Callender with us and Robbie Robinson. So thank God for that. But yeah, it's a shame how many of those people have now passed on. Bill Pearl has passed on. Franco, they mentioned him as one of the judges. So yeah, it's a shame so many of those people, but that was 43 years ago. So it was quite a big time in the past. But of course, Dickerson, amazingly, after winning that and peaking so many times, went on to look even better at the 1980 Mr. Olympia that fall. That's incredible that Chris was able to peak for all those shows and take either first or second, and then take second at the Olympia. Many people thought he could have even won that show, and he probably would have won the show if Arnold had not been there. Casey, on the other hand, although he peaked twice and won two of the shows and dropped down to fifth at the New York show, he was really bad at the Olympia. I think he took 16th. He was toward the bottom along with, and it's funny, Samir was having such a hard time peaking. I mean, that seemed to be his thing throughout his whole career until he finally learned how to peak in 82 and 83. And this was Samir's first year as a competitor, as a pro competitor. So he did very, very well, taking third and fourth in a couple of those shows. So he did really good. And man, I wish somebody had tape of Ed Corney and looking so fantastic and doing that song to My Way from Frank Sinatra. Man, I would love to see that. And they said it was filmed by a Canada TV show. So man, there's got to be footage of it somewhere out there unless it's been destroyed. But man, I would love to see that. I would love to see that whole contest on tape because those guys were in great shape. And then Roy Callender looked great at the Olympia that year. So he peaked again. Robbie did not show up for the Olympia, which was weird. Some people said he knew Arnold was going to win. Danny only did one of those shows in Miami, and he looked pretty good in Australia as well, but he took 10th. And Tom Platz, who they said was out of shape for these Grand Prix shows, was in great shape for the Olympia, took 9th place, and he was really ripped. So yeah, it's interesting how it all played out. And of course, as I said, no one had any idea that Arnold was going to compete and that 1980 Olympia was going to be so controversial. All right, so that's it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane going down to 1980. If you have any suggestions for any other articles you want to hear on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on the weeks we don't have any guests, please shoot me an email and let me know, because I've got a ton of magazines, not only for Muscle and Fitness and Muscle Builder, I've also got a lot of old Iron Man and quite a few muscle mags as well. So just let me know, and I will try to get those up for our next show. All right, guys, have a great week. Train hard, stay safe, and I will see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.